voluntary medication objectors party, which is an Australian political party committed to fighting for the rights for a silent and seething...
It's very silent.
Fighting for a silent and seething minority of our community who believe it is their right to treat their children as they see fit. Because now we're seeing unfair, discriminatory legislation that would take that right away from them. I'm especially honoured tonight to welcome Dr. Judy Wileyman and Professor Brian Martin. They've both undertaken in-depth, original and scholarly analysis of the vaccination issues in Australia. Dr. Wileyman is an expert in her field. She has completed an extensive thesis through Wollongong University, which is a critical analysis of the Australian government's rationale for its vaccination policy, which covers crucial, neglected aspects of vaccination today. Professor Brian Martin is an emeritus professor at the University of Wollongong, Australia, and vice president of Whistleblowers Australia. He's also the author of 17 books and hundreds of articles. That's quite impressive, Brian. We'll hear from both of them shortly. Now, I have a few little points here we have to cover for information for about our seminar tonight. We have a team that are wearing some black caps. Just have a look around. Anybody that you see wearing a black cap, see them. They're our team members, and they are there for any issues that you may have. There we go, some black caps up there. We also ask that any media here to direct your initial inquiries to our team members with their black caps. We also request that there be no filming or photography here. We actually do have an official photographer and video person doing the live stream, and the privacy of our audience here is very important. If you do not wish to be filmed by coming to the front to ask a question during the question and answer time, which will be at the end of when the speakers are finished, then we ask you to write your questions down and give them to a team member, and they can be asked anonymously. And after the seminar, there will also be signed copies of Dr. Wileyman's book, or her thesis, and Professor Martin's book will be available for sale as well. I understand they'll both be for sale. Now, there are also a number of petitions here on government, to the government on vaccines that you're able to find at the book table, and if you feel compelled and motivated to sign them, by all means go ahead when the meetings are finished. Our seminar is, I believe, one of the most important issues we all face today, which is the censorship of the vaccination debate. This is very critical. I've just flown down from Sydney, Brisbane this afternoon, and I picked up the Courier Mail. There was three articles in the Courier Mail today on this issue. I thought, really? It's this important. Three articles today just slamming the mental capacity of people that might have a different view than the current policy, the urgency, the critical urgency, this most emotive appeal by the health minister that please, would you just go and get your vaccination for the flu so we can stop this terrible outbreak that's out of control. And he cited the 1,100 people that died last year from the flu, most of them being over 65. And this was evidence. But, you know, I thought it was very interesting. There is no reference that of these 1,100, was any of them vaccinated? I'm 61. And I know that many of my friends are vaccinated by the flu. They do it. I'm just an observer to this, what they do. And I know they're getting the flu. And many of them will tell us that it was the worst damn flu I've ever had. So there's something's not, we're not getting proper information. But so much for that. Tonight, first up is Brian. Brian is, an emeritus professor at the University of Wollongong, Australia. You have a PhD in theoretical physics from the University of Sydney. Then you worked at the Australian National University for 10 years in applied mathematics before joining the University of Wollongong as a social scientist. As he will tell you, since the late 1970s, he studied suppression of dissent and studied a variety of scientific controversies. Dr. Markle, welcome. We love to hear from you.
Thank you, Michael. Is it working? Okay. In 2010, I received a call from Meryl Dorey. In the mid-1990s, she'd set up a group called the Australian Vaccination Network, which was critical of the normal vaccination recommendations of the government. And they'd been coasting along like a lot of groups like this, but she said since the previous year, they'd come under this a massive attack by a new group that had been set up called Stop the Australian Vaccination Network. Now, why did I receive this call? Just a bit of background about me. I've been studying controversies since the 1970s. I was involved in the nuclear power debate. I've studied pesticides and fluoridation. I wrote a book about the fluoridation controversy. So I was very interested in this. This is the vaccination controversy. And here's someone telling me about what's going on in this controversy. So that interested me. And the other thing in my background is I've been studying dissent in all sorts of ways, also since the 1970s. And originally I was looking at dissent on environmental matters, but then it's broadened into a whole bunch of things. And when Whistleblowers Australia was set up in the 1990s, I became involved. I was president, I'm currently vice president. So I've studied a whole range of things about scientific controversies and about what I call suppression of dissent. And so this sounded exactly up my alley. It's exactly the sort of thing that would interest me. Here it is, it's a scientific controversy that's going on right now, and they're trying to stop the expression of dissenting views in the Australian Vaccination Network. Now, before I go on, I better make one statement. Because you might be critical of people with different viewpoints. Everyone in this debate is concerned about children's health. So we actually have a commonality. What's different is what to do about that concern, where it takes you. So it's important to come back to this, and I'll come back to this at the end. So what I'm going to cover today is first a bit of background about how decisions can be made or could be made about the vaccination issue. Secondly, the attack on the critics of vaccination. And thirdly, what I call panic politics, namely the way in which policy is currently being driven in Australia. So first, let's imagine a hypothetical situation. It doesn't happen in Australia now, but it is you bring a randomly selected group of people together, like a jury for a trial, except this time the jury is going to look at a policy issue, such as vaccination or nanotechnology, air pollution, home births, whatever it is, some issue. They're going to look at that, they're going to hear from people on both sides, hear from experts, read material, and then try and reach a recommendation. There actually have been hundreds of these sorts of juries carried out throughout the world on a whole range of issues, everything from energy policy to various things about you. Okay, so this would be my model of how to proceed. I'm not here to tell you, certainly my view is I would prefer decisions to be made by a group such as this rather than by someone else. Okay, but this does not happen in Australia and certainly not on vaccination. So let's look at a different approach for decision making. And this is the standard one in Australia, is you've got a bunch of so-called experts, medical profession, people in health authorities, they make recommendations to the Minister of Health and the policy gets rolled out. Okay, sounds all very well, maybe. But some people think this is not really about the authorities deciding, it's dictating. So they feel like this is being imposed upon them. And so it's the same sort of thing. So this is a second model. Now the trouble with this model, and this has been the model in Australia in vaccination for many years, is that it's being challenged. There are three main challenges to the authorities. And over since about the 1960s, there's been a gradual challenge to authorities in every field, whether it's politicians, it's the media, medical profession, lawyers. People are taking it upon themselves to learn about the issues and not just accepting what some authorities say from on high. And that's a process that's happening all across, not just in Australia, but it's happening across all of the so-called liberal democracies in the world. It's been highly documented. A second thing that's happened in the vaccination issue is there's been a change in the motivation and driving force behind vaccination. In the early days, you might think of the polio pioneers, they're in it there, you know, their belief is they want to help people. They weren't trying to make money out of it. They had their job for sure, but they had an altruistic orientation. Now I know there's exceptions, but basically that was true up until about the 1980s when pharmaceutical companies came in a big way, and suddenly rather than sharing information with each other in the service of public health, the companies were making intellectual property, they're putting patents on things and trying to make money out of vaccines. Now, that may or may not be of consequence for the actual benefits of vaccines, but it causes a challenge to authority because people don't trust authorities as much if they have a vested interest, and the pharmaceutical companies have a vested interest. So that's a second reason why there's been more questioning of authorities on the vaccination issue. Then the third reason is that there's a lot more vaccines. So my age, we just had a few. Okay, I remember getting polio vaccine 1961, and had a few others. We didn't have very many vaccines, and now there's a whole host of them. And not only are there more now than there used to be, but there are dozens of additional vaccines in the pipeline. So companies are doing vaccines for things which are not infectious diseases. For example, a vaccine for smoking in the pipeline. It might be very good, but nonetheless, people start to get a bit suspicious. There's so many vaccines out there. So these are three reasons why the old model of the authorities decide or the authorities dictate has come under questioning. Now there's another model, and that's that parents decide on vaccination. This is the parental choice or individual choice model. And of course, you can have both. You can have the authorities deciding on a policy, but still letting the parents decide. And so these aren't inherently incompatible, but nonetheless, this is the line in which the Australian vaccination debate has broken down. And we'll come back to these. There's one more model, and I'll deal with that later on. So those are several models for decision-making on vaccination. Now let's look at the big struggle. So the Australian Vaccination Network is like a lot of vaccine critical groups around the world. It's a group of citizens. Many of them have become concerned because members of their family, often their children, have had adverse reactions to vaccines. Or they might have learned about this from somebody else. They become concerned and they want to alert people to this problem. So these groups have been around for a long time, but there was an upsurge in the number of vaccine critical groups. At the same time, the pharmaceutical companies started getting involved with a lot more vaccines. So we've got a cause and effect here is that concerns mimic the promotion. Okay, so the Australian Vaccination Network believes in parental choice and is raising concerns about the adverse effects of vaccines, and also raising questions about
the benefits of vaccines.
2009, another citizens group was formed called Stop the Australian Vaccination Network. Okay, this is a pro-vaccination group, but they're not actually pro-vaccination in the normal sense. They're out there to promote, you know, vaccines. What they're there to do is to try and destroy the Australian Vaccination Network. So I'll call them SAVN, which is the acronym Stop the Australian Vaccination Network. So they set as their goal to destroy the Australian Vaccination Network, and as a broader goal, to silence anyone who is publicly critical of vaccination. So this is the big difference. 2009, up till then, it was is what I had seen in lots of controversies, whether it's pesticides or climate change, whatever, where you've got groups on both sides. One side is often dominant, another side is small dissident viewpoints, but they're able to express their viewpoints. A few exceptions, and that's the thing I said, the suppression of dissent. But nonetheless, the citizen opponents of the dominant view are allowed to express their viewpoint. But suddenly, in this case, in Australia, unlike anything I had ever studied in Australia, anything I had ever heard about in any country in the world, there's a concerted attempt to silence anyone who is critical of vaccination in public. Now, the methods that SAVN used, three types. I've divided into three types, although there's a sort of overall mixture of a whole range of methods, and they sort of bleed into each other. But I've described them in three types: denigration, harassment, and censorship. And I'm going to describe a few of these techniques of each of these types. So first, denigration. Now, if you've read this previous slide about SAVN closely, you've got this little thing saying they believe that vaccines are part of the global conspiracy to implant mind-control chips into every man, woman, and child, that the Illuminati plan a mass cull of humans. So this is SAVN saying, the Australian Vaccination Network people, they all believe in this ridiculous conspiracy. They must be lunatics to believe in anything like that. Now, it's denigration. The strange thing is, I was unable to find any evidence that anyone in the Australian Vaccination Network actually believed in this. Now, Meryl Dorey, she was the leading figure. She said, well, no, that's not her belief at all. And no one else was coming up saying they believe in it. So SAVN alleged that because Meryl Dorey had once made a link to a website, to an article on a website about, and somebody, you know, the owner of the website had these beliefs, therefore she believes in this, and the whole AVN believes in it. It took a long effort by me to challenge them and get them to withdraw this ridiculous thing. So it's no longer on the SAVN website. But they persisted with the claims as long as they could. Now, denigration means lowering someone's reputation. And one of the techniques is simply to cast aspersions on a person, call them names, and so forth. And so Meryl Dorey, she wasn't the only target, but she was the major target for many years. Judy was another target, come to that. And so there's not only was a whole bunch of things put online about her, they even set up a special website to attack her. And I'll just say, Stop the Australian Vaccine Network, SAVN, it's a bit mysterious as to who they are. They're basically a Facebook page, and a whole bunch of commentary on the Facebook page. And you can look it up now and read all the stuff on the Facebook page. All sorts of nasty commentary. Some of its friends, or members, whatever you want to call them, also have their own blogs and a lot of abusive comment on those blogs. So that's where a lot of the denigration comes in, but they've also then gone public with a lot of it and all sorts of attacks on the critics. And because I got involved in this, and Meryl Dorey contacted me and decided I'm going to start looking into this. I looked at all this material and I wrote a long article called Debating Vaccination, as exposing these methods of attack. And so then I got attacked myself. What fun. I love it because I'm researching the attacks and more material for my research projects. This is great. But I collected, these are two of the best comments that I've received. And read them out. You're a disgrace, Brian Martin. Okay. And then Ken, that's Mark Zammit. And then Ken McLeod wrote, yep. Now Ken McLeod said lots of nasty things about me, but this is one I picked out because I especially liked it. He says, yep, that's why I told Martin to fuck off. I don't deal with liars. I pay less attention to him than the dog turd under my shoe. Now personally, I would pay attention to the dog turd under my shoe. But anyway, that's Ken McLeod. And he was one of the leading figures in the attack on the Australian Vaccination Network. So that's a taste of the denigration, but I'm making a bit light of it, and for me it didn't bother me, but it does affect a lot of people, and I know people who drop out of the debate because they've come under abusive attack on the websites, and it's very distressing. Distressing for most people, especially if your career is possibly affected by this. We'll come back to that. So the second main type of method of attack on the vaccine critics they call harassment. And the three types here I've described: complaints, doxing, and threats. And you could call the denigration as a type of harassment, but I've distinguished between the two. So let's look at complaints. At the very beginning, Ken McLeod wrote a long complaint to the Healthcare Complaints Commission, which is supposed to deal with complaints about healthcare professionals, such as doctors and nurses. So why on earth would a citizens group raising concerns about a public issue be considered to be health professionals and subject to a complaint? But anyway, Ken McLeod's complaint was taken seriously by the ACCC. They did an investigation. There's a long story there. They issued a warning, and then seven people then publicized the warning far and wide. You know, this is a very dangerous group because it's got a website, and the website has information that might make people not vaccinate. And then the Office of Liquor, Gaming and Racing, doesn't seem like it's relevant, but the Australian Vaccination Network is an incorporated body, and it was given charitable status, and the Office of Liquor, Gaming and Racing decided, well, you can't take any new members because of this public warning from the ACCC. Then there's complaints to the Fair Trading, which regulates incorporated bodies, and Seven started a campaign to say the Australian Vaccination Network has a misleading name. It must be forced to change its name. And this campaign went on and on. Now, I don't know your politics, but you could say the Liberal Party should change its name to the Conservative Party, or maybe the Labor Party ought to change its name to the Alternative Liberal Party. But no one's forcing any of these other organizations to change their names. It's all this total focus on the AVN. And eventually, there's a great battle, and they said, you've got to change your name. But they didn't say what they had to change it to. And so they're running around registering names. And so they were luckily able to register it as Australian Vaccination Skeptics Network. And this was a red rag to the Stop the Australian Vaccination Network, because they are linked to the Australian skeptics, who believe that the only skepticism that's allowed is skepticism of anything different from orthodoxy. Anyway, so we've now got actually changing the name. And then there's individual practitioners, such as nurses and midwives, doctors, and complaints, if they're detected saying anything critical of vaccination, even on a private Facebook page, this is fed to a website called Reasonable Hank, who then writes a great scree attacking them, saying how terrible they are, and encouraging people to make complaints to the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, which launches an investigation which is threatening to their very livelihood. So it has become very dangerous for anyone who is a health professional to have any expression of criticism of vaccination, because your entire career may be jeopardized. So at the very least, you should be put through a harrowing sort of experience that goes across many months. Okay, and I've heard a number of doctors all about that. So that's the complaints. The second method is doxing. Doxing is when private information about a person, their name, their address, their phone number, anything else, is put online in a context in which it opens them to harassment. So there was this website, not by Salmon, but by someone else, set up a hall of shame, which is included anyone who'd advertised in the Australian Vaccination Network's magazine. And these people were put up there, and some of them received harassing phone calls, quite distressing for those people. So this is doxing, and you could say Reasonable Hank, when he's exposing in his own words, nurses or midwives who are critical of vaccination. He is doxing them in a sense. He may not be putting their private details, but it's a similar sort of process. Put it out there, encourage people to complain about them or to subject them to abuse. So that's the second method. The third method is threats, sending pornographic images. I'm not having a slide of that, sorry to say. But it's actually quite a distressing image that Meryl Dorey and others have received in the post and by email. But the threats, the classic case was when Meryl Dorey was away, there was a phone message left on her answer machine, which she conveniently hooked up to a computer, so she recorded it all, saying, "Die in a fire. Die in a fire," over and over. And so she went to the police. They wouldn't do anything. But she traced the phone number to one of the founders of Stop the Australian Vaccination Network, but he said he didn't do it. So nothing happened, but Meryl Dorey actually challenged it, because she put the recording and all that information on the website of the AVN. Nonetheless, the threats are the serious end of things. And I'll just say, Stop the Australian Vaccination Network. Since they've changed their name to Stop the Anti-Vaccination Network, Australian Anti-Vaccination Network, because they couldn't stomach changing their name to Stop the Skeptics. But anyway, they uniformly reject using these methods. So even though some of their members might do this, they consider them rogue members. So just to be clear, I'm not criticizing every member of Stop the AVN of doing all sorts of terrible things, and there are some reasonable people in that group. But overall, it's very distressing for the people at the receiving end. Anyone who's been harassed in any way, whether it's sexual harassment or complaints, whatever, know how distressing that can be. Extremely distressing. And Meryl Dorey and others have put up with it for years. It's quite amazing. The third method of attack is censorship. Now, you might say denigration and harassment is enough. That's already censoring people because they're afraid to speak out. Okay, but this is more direct censorship. And there are a lot of examples here, but I'm just going to go to a couple. Sherry Tenpenny is a prominent critic of vaccination in the United States, and one of the vaccine critics in Australia, Stephanie Messenger, organized a speaking tour for Sherry Tenpenny. However, the Stop the AVN people found out about it, and they applied pressure to all the venues, and Sherry Tenpenny had to cancel her tour. Now, you know that we had the special security for this event. It's exactly in response to this sort of thing. There's pressure put on venues, and the interesting thing is the pressure put on venues uses the same technique of complaints and denigration. So if you occasionally get a copy of the things that they write to the venues, and it's basically saying, you know, they're lying and that they're dangerous and all that sort of thing. So subsequent to Sherry Tenpenny canceled tour, there's a film called Vexed, directed by Andrew Wakefield and produced by Holly Tommy, who's there, screen there. So Vax is a film which is about the Centers for Disease Control, whistleblower, possible hazards of vaccination. I don't need to go into the details. But because the Australian Vaccination Network knew that if they screened this and they advertised where it was going to be, there'd be massive complaints to the venue and they wouldn't be able to screen it. So they did the same thing as what we did for this talk, which is sell tickets in advance and notify people just beforehand, and actually in some cases notify them to come to a certain location, and then they're led a few blocks away to a different location where the actual talk's held. So the censorship has been so strong that it forces underground techniques, which normally you'd expect in a under a repressive regime, but here it's in something where it's simply citizens having a viewpoint that disagrees with orthodoxy. So then when Polly Tommy was ready to leave Australia, she was told by immigration that she was banned from the country for 3 years because she's obviously a danger to public health. And so what you see here is, this isn't Savin themselves, they can't ban someone. It's immigration has taken the line, or the government's taken the line of censorship. And so I started off by telling about the Australian Vaccination Network and Stop the Australian Vaccination Network. And Savin got support. It got support from groups like the Healthcare Complaints Commission, the Office of Liquor, Gaming and Racing. It's also got politicians on side. It got some media on side, and now it's got the government on side. There's a lot that can be said about how to defend against these attacks. In fact, that's the thing that I've researched the most, but I'm only just going to list them here rather than to go into all the full details. But if you just, you know, Meryl Dorey's response to the threats illustrates, you expose the attack. It's a very potent method. Is you come under attack, you collect all the data, and then you expose it. Because these techniques are so, they're so seen so badly by so many people. When people hear about these techniques, they think, I don't agree with their viewpoint, but they shouldn't be subject to these sort of attacks. Okay, so even people who are sympathetic to, you know, to the Savin don't like their methods. But also, it's important for vaccine critics in this case to behave honorably. In fact, and part of this is you don't counterattack, because if you counterattack, you're just giving them justification for what they're doing. And I say, avoid official channels. I'll just give one example. The Australian Vaccination Network said, oh, Healthcare Complaints Commission made this public warning, but we're going to challenge it in court, because they didn't have jurisdiction to actually give a warning. And they actually won in court. So what did the government do? They changed the law. So you might think, oh yes, we're going to use the official channels to get justice, but it doesn't work when you're the weaker party. Might work a little bit. Okay, so the third part of my talk is about moral panics. Now, as an academic, there's a whole bunch of research on what's called moral panics. And this was done starting back in the 70s. There's a sort of a concern about certain things that are happening. It might be the mods and the rockers back in Britain, back in the 70s, there's certain alternative groups. They're seen as a threat to society, and everyone gets alarmed, and then you get all sorts of media coverage, and then actually sometimes the government actually does something, or maybe it just dies away. So there's all sorts of panics about certain issues. Now, I would say that terrorism is, a lot of that is a moral panic, because the danger from a terrorist attack in Australia is so small, far smaller than the danger of dying in your bathtub. But anyway, you can argue the merits of these, and that's what's done in the moral panic research, is looking at the dynamics. So you got these five features here, and normally moral panic is about something to do with morals. It might be, oh, there's too much sexual freedom, or there's, you know, same-sex marriage, things going on. And we've got road rage. There's one picture I've got. Road rage, a great danger from this. Whether or not it's actually a danger, maybe it's being blown up much bigger than it deserves to be. So this is the nature of moral panic. So we can look at it as a vaccination panic. So in this case, it's exactly the same thing. Now, vaccination isn't a moral issue per se, but it's turned into a moral issue because the people who don't have their children vaccinated are seen to be threatening the lives of other children. This is the argument. So it's got the same sort of dynamic. You've got the media coverage in Australia, especially through the Murdoch media. I'm not sure how much public concern is built up, but it's certainly, a lot of us follow the media. And then you got the politicians and the media commentators have responded. And there have been policy changes. Now, before I describe the policy changes, let's just look at the comparison to a few other critics of orthodoxy. Okay, there's critics of nuclear power. I know all about this because I've studied this. And the ordinary critic of nuclear power, citizen critic, fine. Go ahead and criticize all you like. In fact, it's almost become dominant view now. But back in the 70s, this was a real radical sort of thing to be critical of nuclear power. You know, keeping uranium in the ground, that was a wild sort of thing. But no government's ever come down heavy on the critics of nuclear power. Likewise, pesticides. There's individuals who are concerned about pesticides, some living on the land, some in urban areas. And government's not intervening against them. But vaccine critics are different. And so you've got a government ban of polytomy intervening in the vaccination debate, intervening in free speech, if you like. So let's look at the actual outcomes of what I call the vaccination panic. So the panic starts, the alarm stopped the Australian Vaccination Network. It harnesses certain government groups like Healthcare Complaints Commission, gets media on side, and then gets politicians on side, and the politicians are driving these changes in policy. You've heard of them, I'm sure. No jab, no play, no jab, no pay, and the removal of conscientious objection, which is a major impact of this. And also, the fourth one you may not be so familiar with. In the mainstream of pro-vaccination thought in Australia, this is like the College of Physicians, they do not want these measures. They do not want no jab, no pay, no jab, no play. Okay? Because they can see that's going to harm the children. They're more concerned about the children than just enforcing a vaccination policy. But this is why I call it a panic, is that the government has overruled the experts in the medical profession, and decided we're going to impose this to silence these vaccine critics and to force as many people as possible to get their vaccines. coming to the summary here. We go back to this, we've got four types of decision making. Describe the citizen's jury, which doesn't, there's not a hope of that ever coming in Australia in the near term. You've got the authorities decide, or the authorities dictate, which has been the dominant thing up until a few years ago. It's been the dominant way. Parents decide has been, up until a few years ago, has been allowed because there's been conscious objection. But now we're in panic-driven policy. No jab, no pay, no jab, no play, is driven by a panic about the dangers of anyone speaking out critical of vaccination. And the policy has followed the panic. It's not even rational from the point of view of the mainstream pro-vaccination people. Just to summarize a few points. First, we need to look at this, like I said at the beginning. The people on both sides of this debate care about children's health, but they disagree about how to go about it. So you've got citizen campaigners on both sides of this debate. But the debate can become highly abusive. We've seen that in the denigration, the harassment, the threats, all the rest. So there are many techniques used to attack the critics. But there's one other thing that I just want to leave you with, and that is something that is hard to grasp because it is outside the terms of this debate. The focus on vaccination means that other ways of improving health, more generally, get sidelined. And there's other ways that do much more. Now, you could say we should all stop drinking alcohol, and that'll cut the number of accidents, cut the amount of cirrhosis of the liver, and it'll cut the amount of domestic violence. Okay? But no one is saying, the people who sell alcohol shouldn't be allowed to speak because it's so dangerous to the public. It's totally off the planet to imagine that. So we've got a double standard. But let me just focus instead not on the wider dimensions, because I've mentioned a few of these in my book. There's other ways to boost immunity. And I've started collecting a few scientific research articles on other ways to improve immunity. And there's a lot of good research, and not nearly as much research on these as on vaccines, though. A lot of research on vaccines, but less research on nutrition, exercise, mindfulness. There's a bunch of others, but let's say sleep. If you get a good night's sleep nearly every night, your immunity will be much greater. You're much less likely to catch the flu, all these other things. So where is the group called Stop the Sleep Deprivers? Yeah, we don't have that group because the enemies of sleep are pervasive in society, and all the distractions, the computer distractions, the noise, you can name a whole bunch of them. Anyway, we'll go into that. So these are the issues that I think are being sidelined by the vaccination debate. So those who are really interested in vaccination, I'm not trying to discourage you from that issue, just to point out there's a wider canvas in which you can look as well. Now, before I turn over to Judy, I just want to give a little bit of background, is that Judy started a PhD with me in 2007. That was before I got involved in the debate. She was just working on her PhD, that was fine. But then Stop the AVN got going, and Judy was active in the debate critical of vaccines, and this most massive attack upon Judy and her research. Now, once again, I've been studying politics of higher education for decades, especially interested in free speech, academic freedom, all that sort of thing. And I keep tabs on the sort of things that go on. Never in my life had I ever heard of an attack on a PhD student or recent graduate like the one who has used the attack on Judy. And I've written a number of articles about it, but just to say, she is qualified through her PhD, but also through the searing experience of actually trying to get her PhD in the face of incredible obstacles. So, thank you very much.
The propaganda campaign. And I'll also say that as someone who has reached the pinnacle of the education system in Australia, it's actually mortifying to find that your research, which is supported by a university, is suddenly banned by all council buildings around Australia, and publicly so through the media. So this is the situation that we have in Australia today. That goes against all scientific principles. Science needs to be scrutinised in order to protect public health. And the Australian government is currently censoring this debate. And the people that you heard about that have been banned from this country include medical doctors, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and parents whose children became autistic after vaccines, and they know that was the case. And they are not being allowed to present that side of the issue to the public. So I'm going to expand on a few of the issues that Brian mentioned, and hopefully simplify the debate for you. Because you'll notice that the only kind of debate you're getting is anti-vaxxers versus pro-vaxxers. Now, what is the definition of anti-vaccination? The Medical Board of Australia has not provided any definition of anti-vaccination. I'll tell you what it is. That is the risks of a medical procedure. Now, what medical procedure do you know that is ever dismissed as being anti the procedure? We won't talk about the risks of that procedure because that's anti the procedure. Does that protect your health? And yet we currently have a health minister that has stated that as well. So at this point in time, the Australian public's health is at risk. Until we have evaluated the depth of the risks of vaccines, as the government has slowly added more to the schedule while no one's watching, and this is a schedule that has never been tested for its entirety in vaccinated and unvaccinated groups using an inert placebo. These are the things that parents are trying to tell you, but the media is not assisting. And there is no scrutiny of this science. My thesis has been put out there, and people without qualifications have been allowed to denigrate my thesis in the Australian media, and the University of Wollongong stays silent. But be assured, the University of Wollongong is standing by that research. And the government would tell you that this is all about people using fraudulent studies. Now, the only studies that are used by the government in vaccination policies are funded by pharmaceutical companies. And they are not, there is no independent assessment of those studies before they are recommended to the governments. And we're not just talking about fraudulent studies. We're talking about a lack of scientific principle in the entire policies of the Australian government. And so today I'm going to try and show you the politics of how Australia's vaccination policies have been developed. And whilst you have been presented with this as being a conspiracy theory, that is not a word that was ever used in my thesis. I provided to you in my thesis the politics of how the money is driving this policy. We have advisory boards with conflicts of interest, and we have a TGA that's fully funded by the industry itself that approves all the drugs for the market. Now, so firstly, I'm going to start. Let's have a look at what sort of policies we have in place today. These policies, we've got mandatory and coercive vaccination. Now, is it for public health? Right. We need to look at how is the government assessing these policies. So what I'm going to do now is just go through the nuts and bolts. I've had to pull out the things which I think are most important to get the message across to you today. Right. But let's put it this way to start with. It is the parents whose interest in this policy is the risks of a medical procedure. Right, so let's just expand a bit on parental choice, which is what Brian talked about. We're not just talking here about parental choice. We're talking here about the Geneva Convention and the Nuremberg Code, informed consent, fully informed consent, without coercion, without financial inducements. Did you know that your doctor is paid for each child they vaccinate? Did you know that the medical practice that he or she belongs to gets a bonus of thousands of dollars if they raise the immunisation rates in the population? Now, I'm going to show you now how these policies are being assessed by the government for their success and how they are being promoted to the public. Right, now, but you must always be careful. If someone says to you that something is anti-vaccination, but they're dismissing the risks of this medical procedure, and you need to redefine this debate for them and say, no, that's not correct. We need to weigh up the risks and benefits of this procedure to see if using 16 vaccines in an infant before the body systems are developed and before the blood-brain barrier is developed, to see if that is a sensible thing to do. Because I can assure you, as someone who vaccinated, because I thought it was automatic, like you are all being taught to think today, when you look at what's in the vaccine, there's not a chance in the world that you would put that stuff injected into the tissues of the body. And it is very important that you know that injecting into the tissues is quite different to the way your children get exposed to viruses and bacteria naturally in the air. And all the chemicals that they then get injected into the body with that vaccine that you're not being told about. Okay, so there's a lot of issues here. So I'll start, I will start firstly with Brian's comment. Because when I attempted to debate my research in public, I was abused and ridiculed. And in fact, universities are now in partnership with industry and the medical professions. And in fact, the university's procedures, their complaint procedures, were allowed to be used by lobby group activists, people in Savin who have connections with industry-funded lobby groups. Right? They were allowed to use the university's policies, and these were people without qualifications, and they would make anonymous complaints that were investigated without providing confidentiality to myself. And then they would publicise these complaints in the media to denigrate my research with not a scrap of evidence. And that is, and I was allowed to be harassed and abused throughout my 4 years completing the PhD at Wollongong University. The university allowed its policies to be used by lobby group activists in that way without providing me with confidentiality. So this is the comment that Brian made in one of his papers. This is a clear and direct attack on academic freedom. I have studied issues of intellectual freedom for many years. Never have I heard of a campaign against a research student as relentless and abusive as the one against Judy. But anybody who speaks up in support of the clear scientific arguments that I'm presenting would lose their job. But the people are being required to promote vaccines and to support the government's policy. You'll notice that doctors, if they present anti-vaccination material, and that goes for nurses and midwives as well, they will then be investigated by APRA, the Australian Health Practitioners Regulatory Board, and they can be deregistered. That is their livelihood, that is their career. And they no longer have autonomy to discuss the risks of this medical procedure, because our regulatory board that is run by the government considers this anti-vaccination. Now, it is the public interest in this policy. This is you that needs to protect your health. We cannot sit back and allow the government to roll out these policies at this point in time. They're going very quickly because the majority of people are not being directly affected now. But you will be in the future. The plan is to vaccinate from cradle to grave, and they have 200 more vaccines in the pipeline, and they can mandate these for the population, for welfare benefits, they've already done that. For people's careers, did you know that nurses and health professionals now at university cannot choose their career without getting 10 to 16 vaccines? that's compromising their health because we have a genetically diverse population. So there's a lot here that I will go through this presentation and try to give you the nuts and bolts of why we cannot sit back. We need everybody to fight for the public interest in this policy. The corporations have been driving this policy, and I'll show you that institutional bias as we go through the presentation. So, is this a health policy? Now, if it was a health policy, then it would be evaluated on the improvements in children's health. Right? We would assess it for children's health, and that's how it would be promoted to the government. The government does not use children's health as a measure of the success of vaccination programs. Nor does it use the infant mortality rates. Originally, they used to use infant mortality rates. But in 1995, they discovered that children's infant mortality rates were increasing. There were more deaths the more vaccines that came to the schedule. So they abandoned using infant mortality rates, and they now promote vaccines to you. You will hear Greg Hunt and the other ministers saying to you, we must have 95% immunisation rates in the population. Okay, so there's an assumption there that a high immunisation rate equals good health. But the opposite is actually true. The opposite is happening. The more we vaccinate children, the sicker our children are getting with chronic illnesses. And I'll explain why that's the case a bit later. So basically, the countries using the most vaccines have the highest infant mortality rates, that's deaths, and morbidity, which is illness, rates in their children and in the population. Now, as an example, the US and Australia, we actually use the highest number of doses of vaccine. So before a child is 12 months old, that's 1 year, Australia is using 24 doses of vaccine. So for the older generation who is not aware that how much the schedule is expanded, this is the issue for parents today, and we need to be aware that they're over-vaccinating. US is using 26 doses in that first year of life. Now, the countries that are using half that number, Sweden, Japan, Singapore, have infant mortality rates that are half the US and Australia. So that is why the government does not use illness in children, which has skyrocketed fivefold over the last two decades in terms of chronic illness, autoimmune diseases, neurological disability, and autism is exponentially increasing. And if we don't have this debate, the society will be dysfunctional. So every person in this room needs to get involved, and we need to spread this information by word of mouth, because our corporate-sponsored media is not assisting in this issue. So assessing vaccination programs. The government is using 95% immunisation rates in the population. Now, when in any country's history has a vaccine been used with an uptake of 95% to control any disease, particularly prior to 1990, there is none, not even smallpox. Smallpox, they admitted only 50% of the global population was vaccinated because they didn't have enough vaccine. And the reason smallpox was actually eradicated was to do with the characteristic of the virus itself. It is the only virus that is transferred contact to contact. And you know, we were using the smallpox vaccine for 150 years before finally, in 1950 and 60, smallpox was eradicated. But by that time, public health measures, your hygiene, sanitation, nutrition, was all put in place. And because smallpox virus is only transferred by contact to contact, it was that the cases were easily isolated because it's only communicable once the symptoms appear. So they isolated the cases, and with the improvements in hygiene, nutrition, and sanitation, smallpox was eradicated at the same time as all the other infectious diseases declined. Now, I'm going to show you this history with a few slides in a minute. But this is a fallacy that we need 95% immunisation rates for 16 diseases. Are you aware that some of those vaccines were only added to the schedule in 2013? And then by 2015, when the government wanted to put in a no jab, no pay, to shore up the markets for the pharmaceutical companies, they mandated even things like chickenpox vaccine, rotavirus for gastroenteritis, meningococcal, pneumococcal, diseases that were not a serious risk to the majority of the Australian population. The vaccines had never controlled those diseases. They were only introduced in 2013. But sure enough, they were mandated with coercive financial inducements for parents and at the same time as the other vaccines on that schedule. Now, this is not necessary. And a 95% immunisation rate in the population, the government doesn't know what health effects that will have on children, because it's never been done in history. Prior to 1990, the push for increased immunisation rates started in 1990. And that was after the 1985 Liability Act went through in the US government. They were finding so many compensation claims were being put against the pharmaceutical companies for vaccine injuries that in the US, liability was removed from all vaccines that are licensed in the US, and the government is now running a vaccine injury compensation scheme that has paid out over $4 billion. And that's only to approximately 10% of vaccine injured people because it's so hard to get that through. It's very challenging. And, you know, in Australia here today, we don't have any compensation for our vaccine injured children. They do exist, and we have a very sick generation of children because of the chronic illnesses that are building up with the extra vaccines that we're giving them. So we need to start thinking about all these issues. So if you're going to use immunisation rates to promote vaccines to the public, they're only using the assumption that that's improving the health of the population. And the fact is that the statistics do not support that. As I mentioned, fivefold increase in chronic illnesses and autoimmune diseases and autism. So we need to. This situation couldn't happen if the government was required to promote this with the statistics on the health of our children. So we need to go back to the historical literature. And you will hear these industry-funded lobby groups like SAVIN, which is linked to the Australian Skeptics Incorporated, which is an organisation that has links to promoting corporate interests in government policies. Right? And their interests are different to the parents' interests, the risks of medical procedures. Right. So when I went back through the history and looked at what controlled infectious diseases, because what parent would want to be going against vaccines if they had controlled diseases? Now, McFarlane Burnet was our Nobel laureate in 1960, and he had this to say about vaccines. His laureate was in immunology, and he studied them for several decades. He said, in 1960, this is very prophetic, genetics, nutrition, psychological, and environmental factors may play a more important role to resistance of disease than the assumed benefit of artificial immunity induced by vaccination. They were already aware at that time that vaccines were linked to hypersensitivity, that's allergies, anaphylaxis, and autoimmune diseases. The research had already begun. These things were known. It was also known that infectious diseases are a public health issue. They were not a medical issue, and they were not controlled by vaccines at that time. There's not a single public health official that will support, from the first half of the 20th century, well, in fact, throughout the 20th century, that says vaccines controlled infectious diseases. So I'll provide you with a few quotes. But firstly, I'd like you to look at what causes infectious diseases. And this is what McFarlane Burnet was alluding to. And this is the public health description of how we get an infectious disease. These bacteria and viruses are around us all the time. It is your environmental circumstances and your host characteristics, the stress, the sleep, the your genetics. All of this plays a role in whether you will get sick from the disease and how sick you'll get. And the environmental conditions, if you live in a dirty, filthy environment, that's why developing countries still have these diseases rife. There's a much higher risk of these diseases in the developing countries because of the poor environmental circumstances. So in a developed country, the risk from infectious diseases declined by 1950 to 60. The virulence of these diseases declined with the improvements in sanitation, hygiene and nutrition, big factor, right? So it's not just the agent that causes the disease. And often you'll get an asymptomatic case of the disease, no symptoms, but long-term immunity. And that's where the term herd immunity originally came from, that natural immunity. After the risk of the disease had declined after 50s and 60s, we were getting mild cases of these diseases that were beneficial and giving us long-term immunity. And that's what is still protecting the herd immunity in developed countries today. Right? But the vaccine manufacturers realised this was a thing that they could say. They, through the media, money is power, and they've had the power to say that vaccines are creating herd immunity, but they haven't provided any evidence for that. They easily could, as we talked about with in Brian's talk, if the Medical Board of Australia was to provide to you the statistics of the hospitalised cases of infectious disease in Australia. So when they say there's an outbreak of measles or an epidemic of whooping cough, they need to provide to us from independent source the number of those cases arriving at the hospital, these serious cases, that are vaccinated and the number that are unvaccinated. What we know confidently is that many vaccinated people are still getting the diseases they're vaccinated against. And there has been no proof provided that vaccine-created herd immunity is real and is protecting the population. But many of us would be very happy to accept that if we see the evidence, but none has been provided. So they've simplified the cause of these diseases to you, and they've told you that a vaccine will be effective when in fact many of you aren't at risk of getting these diseases because it's a result of your constitution and genetics and environmental circumstances as well. So you don't have to fear these diseases in a developed country like Australia. So let's see what the officials were saying by 1950. Lancaster was one of the prominent public health officials of the time, and he said, as causes of infant mortality in Australia, all the infective diseases have been overcome. And that was whooping cough, measles, influenza, all taken off the national notified disease list at that time because they were no longer considered diseases of serious concern to the majority of people. They still existed, but people knew if they got them at the right age, which is over 6 months of age, that it would either be a mild case or an asymptomatic case, and they would get long-term immunity and the community was better protected. Can I tell you that a measles vaccine did not come into Australia until 1970. 1969 to 1970, that was 20 years after measles was taken off the national notifiable disease list in 1950. And throughout that time, parents were not frightened of measles. There were measles parties, like chickenpox parties, because the risk is very, very rare. It is a complication of measles. That can be an issue, and that's to do again with your circumstances, your environmental or host characteristics that have made that particular person more susceptible. Okay? So there's a lot of misinformation being put out, but it's not by the parents. The AVN is a parents' organisation, a grassroots parents' organisation that started up to try and tell you this information. And we shouldn't need to do a PhD to be able to debate this scientific literature. So also the decline of infant mortality rate. Now this is a direct quote from Fiona Stanley, our Australian of the Year in Public Health in 2003. The rates of infectious diseases in Australia were very low from 1950 to 2000, and the majority of the fall in the under 5 mortality rates, that's 80% of it, had occurred by 1960. And she said, This was prior to the introduction and widespread use of the majority of vaccines. So, throughout the 20th century, vaccines were voluntary. They did not control these diseases. And yet, in 2015, the Australian government made vaccines mandatory, and it made 16 vaccines mandatory, vaccines that weren't even used throughout the 20th century, with these financial inducements, but just for some of the population, not all of the population. Don't you think that if it was essential that we vaccinate to create herd immunity, that they would have done it for the entire population at that time? But that didn't happen. They picked on the people that needed welfare, the students, the health students, choosing their careers. This issue is dividing families. It is many students and many parents come to me distraught because their children are bullied to use these vaccines and they want to become a doctor. They want to become a nurse. They want to do midwifery. But they're forced to have 16 vaccines. That's quite a choice. That's quite a decision to make. And there's no evidence that that decision is necessary. And there's court cases because misinformation is being put out through the media by these industry-funded lobby groups pushing vaccines. They're only promoting vaccines. That's why the issue is vitriolic. The only health the Savin and the Friends of Science in Medicine are actually looking at our infectious diseases. But chronic illness determines our quality of life. But they're ignoring autism. They don't acknowledge the fivefold chronic illness in allergies and anaphylaxis, life-threatening celiac disease, parents going to parties concerned that their child might die because they even smell some peanut butter. This didn't happen prior to 1990. I was a school teacher. We all noticed the gradual increase through the 90s, and that's why I'm here today. Parents do not have an agenda in telling you about the risks of vaccines. We're concerned about the health of children, chronic illness, as well as infectious diseases. And that's why we have looked into this through a PhD. And I'm the only person in Australia that is not contacted for comment. And the politicians have been told not to listen to or not to see me to present information for these policies. So epigenetics. There is nothing scientific about these policies. It is as clear as the nose on your face. Genetics is the primary determinant of your health, whether it be from an infectious disease or an environmental factor. We all know about epigenetics now. It's been highly researched. The Prime Minister's most prestigious prize last year in 2017 was given to Jenny Graves for her work in epigenetics and the effects of environmental toxins on the DNA of organisms and humans, etc. At the same time, our government is blanketly mandating with financial inducements a medical intervention for the entire Australian population, which is genetically diverse. Many people have a predisposition to some of these genetic diseases, and they will be harmed by these vaccines. That is a crime against the Australian population under the Nuremberg Code. That is why the Nuremberg Code exists. It is why the Geneva Convention is founded on the Nuremberg Code. So doctors now are conflicted. Because the Australian government, the Medical Board of Australia, in its good practice medical guidelines, has required doctors to promote the government's vaccination policies. Now, what the clause says is that any medical practitioner that is presenting anti-vaccination material, now let's reframe that, risks of this medical intervention, any medical practitioner that presents risks of vaccination will be investigated by APRA, and we currently have several doctors and chiropractors and other health professionals being investigated and harassed for their integrity in looking after our health. And other doctors and nurses and midwives cannot stand up. They cannot. They lose their livelihood. They get the same treatment. They get the treatment that I got. Because the university's policies supported the lobby groups to harass me and abuse me and denigrate my research in the mainstream media without supportive evidence. That also has been complained to the New South Wales Ombudsman, but like the police and like APRA, nothing was done. And there are many of us that are burnt out. Wakefield, same treatment. There's a lovely film that's just been put out on Andrew Wakefield's work, A Man of Integrity. It shows how the lies have been told about him, again by someone connected with the Australian Skeptics Incorporated lobby groups. And it shows how events have been misinterpreted to frame people to look like, to smear their reputation. And we now have a new word in the Australian language, the English language. People are being Wakefielded, like myself and like these doctors that try to speak up. We need a debate on health. We need to weigh up the risks and benefits of vaccination. And without this debate, as I said, the society will become dysfunctional because of its genetics. Like McFarlane Burnett predicted, the genetics of the population is being undermined. And neurological damage is occurring. And this is preventable. These diseases, chronic illness and autoimmune diseases, your diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, that they've been associated with vaccines for decades. Encephalopathy, seizures, paralysis, cerebral palsies. They've been on the package inserts for decades. And the Institute of Medicine has actually linked many of them causally now. But this is not getting to the public. The Australian media is censoring it, along with the Australian government health ministers, because they are being influenced by these lobby groups. So epigenetics, most of you are aware, it's about the genetic predisposition to disease. And the government mandates these drugs. Vaccines are a drug, and they've got 6 or 7 chemicals in it which you don't know about. Even if your doctor was required to tell you what was in the vaccine before you gave your consent, that would help. So there's two things. We must insist that the government promotes these vaccines on the health of our children. What are the statistics saying? And we must insist that our doctors tell us. See, the doctors actually aren't educated on the ingredients of vaccines. So I recommend that you go to the government website, look at the ingredients, print them off, ask your doctor, challenge your doctor, ask him what's in a vaccine and see what he says. And also ask to see the real package insert, because that will list all the side effects, the adverse events that they know are associated, even if some of them haven't been causally linked yet. But that's the whole point. The precautionary principle, you can only protect public health in a government policy if you prove first that the policy's not causing harm. The Australian government has reversed that. They're asking you to prove the harm. And they're the ones that have the money to fund the studies, but they haven't funded the correct studies. They don't use an inert placebo, because the pharmaceutical companies are the only ones doing this research that's being used in government policy. So this government policy is knowingly causing harm in an unknown number of Australians. This is a crime. Epigenetics. So basically, heavy metals, chemicals, viruses, bacteria, nutrition, emotional states and stress are all triggers to your genes. You have genes that need to be switched on sometimes for them to produce some disease or condition. You will not have a problem with that condition unless one of these factors triggers it. And that's where the damage is happening in populations today. We do need to weigh up how many vaccines we use, which ones are essential and which ones are not. Many of these are found in vaccines, or those triggers. So, is the control of infectious diseases a public health issue or a medical issue? Right. The control of infectious diseases was never a medical issue until 1970. And that's when the industry medical complex developed, and the doctors took over the policy, and the myths that are actually being taught to your children from kindergarten to university students now, they literally do say in the curriculum, vaccines do not cause autism. That has not been proven. And they literally say vaccines control these diseases and create herd immunity. Again, the evidence has not been provided by the Medical Board of Australia. They did not provide it when these policies were pushed through the social welfare department. They weren't in the health acts in Australia at the time. You'll know that vaccines were always mandatory and not compulsory, even when they pushed through the no jab, no pay for a small section of the community. But people don't tend to get involved in these debates until it affects them. And this is where our problem is, that they know that, and they're hoping that the public will just let this happen, and then it could be too late. Once the legislation's in, it's hard to reverse. So, it is the media that's shaping your beliefs, and they don't contact people like myself who have studied the control of infectious diseases to provide you with information. They actually provide you with information from other people that misinterpret my research and talk about conspiracy theories, etc. So these are the lobby groups that do push the corporate interests. Now, the evidence I have that they're pushing corporate interests is that they're ignoring the health of our children. They don't talk about the increase in chronic illness or the increase in autism. They actually tell you that autism isn't caused by vaccines when it hasn't been proven. The only person whose interest that is in is industry interests. It's not in the public interest when we haven't got the evidence, the hard evidence to prove those things. And that can be done if the right studies within our placebos are done, or if you use the serious hospitalised cases of these diseases when they occur to see if the vaccines are protecting the public. You know, that evidence can be provided, but as yet it has not. So the final influence in public health policy, I'll go through this slide. I'm not sure how much time I have left, but so if people could just let me know when to finish. This slide in particular is very helpful in terms of the politics of how this has happened. So I will go through this one. Firstly, our government regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administrator, whilst it's a government board, it's 100% funded by industry. They call it a cost, they justify it as being a cost recovery system. Now, what that means is that the TGA is approving vaccines, which are drugs, for the market, but their other role is to monitor the adverse events from those drugs. Now, in all the 60 to 70 years that we've been vaccinating, do you think they've set up an adequate surveillance system to determine causal links between vaccines and adverse events? No, but they could have. The only way you can make a causal link is if you monitor the health of every vaccinated person over the long term to see, so you can see the patterns. Right. So if this is something they could have set up, every person that gets the vaccine, right, that their health outcomes need to be recorded, right, over a period of at least 5 years, because a lot of the adverse events have a latent effect. They can come out months or years later. These are your autoimmune diseases, such as arthritis, multiple sclerosis, lupus, diabetes, things like that. Okay, so you do have to have an active surveillance system for a period of 5 to 6 years minimum to see what the long-term health events are. In fact, you know, even in the phase 1 to 3 trials, they only study adverse events over a period of about 3 weeks in some cases. There's no long-term health outcomes. And they don't monitor the combined schedule that a child gets. All of those 16 vaccines over that first year of life, what are the effects of that? They've never done that because they just add one here this year and then two the next year and three the next year. And that's critical to our health. So they're the things that we need to demand. It's never been done. And again, you know, this is because it's an agent of industry. It's not in their interest to have an active surveillance system. However, you'll hear about every non-serious case of an infectious disease, and the media will tell you to your blue in the face that we've had a case of meningococcal. But did you know that the majority of those cases survive? And that they're at a small risk? The majority of the population isn't even at risk of meningococcal and pneumococcal. Again, it's environmental and host-related. but we're not told that through the media. It is fear-mongering. So that's starting right at the top of the government. We then have the Gavi Alliance. Well, in fact, I should have put that round the other way, because the Gavi Alliance is the alliance that recommends vaccines to the World Health Organization, and then the World Health Organization recommends them to 193 member countries. So, firstly, the makeup of the Gavi Alliance, it includes the Federation of Pharmaceutical Companies. It includes the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Now, is that non-biased information? Do you think that group is going to provide objective advice to the World Health Organization? But you see, you don't get told that it's the Gavi Alliance directing vaccine policy. You get told the World Health Organization recommends these vaccines to countries, member countries. So there's a front organization that has a reputation for objectivity, but who's behind the drive to use all these vaccines and develop the new biotechnology for some of these vaccines? So these conflicts of interest, money is driving this policy, and there's no evidence that we need all these vaccines. So again, the World Health Organization is not using objective recommendations. The ATACI is our Australian Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation. The majority of members within that advisory board have financial conflicts of interest with the pharmaceutical companies, including the chairman of that board. Chairman Terry Nolan, who was the chairman for a decade, from 2005 to 2014, when the government was forced to put on its website the conflicts of interest of people in that board due to parental pressure. But Terry Nolan retired before that happened. His conflicts of interest were mentioned in journal articles and things like that, but the public was not informed that the chairman, who reports directly to our health minister, the federal health minister, did have financial conflicts of interest with the pharmaceutical companies. So these things are important for the public to know, to make a judgment on the information they receive. The NCIRS is again another Australian government advisory board. It is the funding for vaccines comes from the pharmaceutical companies to do the research, and again, many of its members have financial conflicts of interest with the companies as well. The Public Health Association of Australia supports the Stop the Australian Vaccination Network in its strategies to suppress academic literature like my own, to suppress medical doctors who want to come to Australia, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and others, Polly, who's a parent with the autistic child. 7 outright describes the strategies it's using to suppress the scientific debate on vaccines, and it is supported by our Public Health Association of Australia that again provides research to the government for our policies. That is not an objective policy. All right. So again, the university is now in partnerships with industry and medical boards. Their funding drives the research, and the university researchers also have equity in the research that's done. And much of this medical research, the funding of medical journals now is skewing the results of research, because they publish the positive studies and the negative ones don't get published often. So we have a corporate-sponsored media regulating, which tells the public that we can't present the other side of this debate because that would be false balance. So they're making that claim on the assumption that, their claim that there's a consensus on the science. But there's no consensus on the science. There are many scientists and parents who know that the risks of these multiple vaccines is harming our children, and we want this debate. But journalists at the moment are being protected by our Australian Communications and Media Authority because they've been influenced by lobby groups that are saying there is a consensus on the science, and that includes the Medical Board of Australia that's making that claim. Our corporate model of health is being used, which means again that the corporations have influence in the statistics and research that are presented to you on vaccines in the media. okay? So it's not objective statistics you're receiving through our media about infectious diseases and the risks that they pose or the benefits that vaccines give. And as I mentioned before, doctors who present anti-vaccination material, including nurses and midwives, are gagged from speaking up by the medical profession's regulations. The Medical Board of Australia will investigate your doctors. They've removed the autonomy of our medical professionals. Now, all the ethical research on health promotion says in order to promote health in a community, doctors must have autonomy and patients must have autonomy over their own health care and the decisions that are made. But our Medical Board of Australia has removed that in Australia, and patients also are being bullied by doctors and health, midwives, nurses to have these vaccines. So informed consent without coercion is not being practiced in Australia any longer, and that's often financial coercion that's going with that. And that is very serious. It is a breach of the Nuremberg Code. It allows experimentation on the population. Okay, so I hope that I've got through some of the biases, the way the political issues that are preventing the debate from happening and preventing the public from actually protecting our health in this government policy. It seems outrageous to me that we should have to fund our own campaign to protect our health in this policy. Many of us are burnt out. You know, it's not sustainable what's happening. We need the public to pick this up because the public's health will be destroyed and the genetics of the population is currently under attack. So I'll leave it there. I'm sure you've got plenty of questions and other things will come out in the questions. Thank you.